Yes, sir.
People who have the prayer memorized and the ones who read it off paper seem to be saying something different.
Can you clarify that?
Yeah. We get to the line that says, Saki's insult be built in the room.
Yeah.
Okay? You see what says, Saki's insult be built in the room. The key is in the jinsult. Jinso means giving and the other system and the other five perfections. Jinso. So generally when you're doing this prayer by yourself and you're using it to take refuge and pray for bodhicitta, you say jinso. Before a class, students say Daki Chunyin. Daki Chunyin. So you replace jinso with Chinyin. Because you're praying that as a result of your listening Nyan to Dhamma Chu in the class, you'll be able to gain Bodhicitta. And ultimately you attain Buddhahood. So you're praying for that, that the virtue of your coming to class. And the teacher says Chu She, which is by the virtue of my talking about Dhamma, expressing Dhamma. So that the class at that point would say, Daki Chunyin Gibbisun. And the teacher should say, Daki Chushin Gibbisun. But when you're by yourself at home, you say, Daki Jinso Gibbisun.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. We're going to do, continuing with the depth meditation. And, do you think there's any announcements for us?
When is the plan?
Oh, that's a good question. Thursday will be a review, and if you've never been in a review before, that's when you get all the answers to the final. So, good to come. We go over all the important points in the class, and we go over what's on the final. I don't care if the final's not a big surprise. I just want you to know what I think is the most important things to know. Because the point is that by the end you know those last 25 most important things. So all the information in the class got boiled down to 8 or 9 homework questions every class. And then all the homework questions got boiled down to 4 or 5 quiz questions every class. And the final only comes from the quizzes. Because I think those are the most important things. So half the quiz questions get thrown out. And what's left is the information that I expect you to remember a year from now. And, you know, people talk about these big geshes, but 2 years after you finish your geshe, you don't remember, it's like 2 years after you finish your PhD in, math or something, you don't really remember everything. You probably don't remember more than half after about 2 years. And so part of the idea of the course is that you get the information that really counts, and that sticks in your brain. And the final is that. So the final boils down to 25 points, 25 pieces of information that would really help your life and that you really must try to remember. So that's the idea of the final. So we'll do a review on Thursday. Did you tell me how long you need? I don't know. Do you want to do 10 days? Or is that too long? You want to do a week? It's a week, okay?
Week.
So take the final on the following Thursday. Is that right? No? Okay, so we'll take the final on the following Thursday. That'll be the same time, same place.
Any alternative dates? Maybe when the Tibetan track does it or something?
Yeah, I'm not sure. What is the Saturday? Yeah, so they'll probably do it a week from Saturday. How's that? So it's either the following Thursday or the following Saturday at 10. We'll announce on Thursday. We'll probably try to arrange some classes by Art and Carmen during the interim. I think we can do a weekend retreat, a 3-day retreat, a very intensive one. So if you're interested in that, tell me on Thursday. I think we might have to restrict the amount of it, so I'm not trying to be cute, but if you're really serious about it, then it would be very intensive. It would go like from a Friday evening to a Sunday afternoon. Don't know the location yet. Somewhere close. I don't know yet. Maybe Doug. We didn't get that far.
Next class.
Next class around July 15th. And it will be denial. We've covered all five books, the great books of Buddhism plus Lamrim. We've done something from all of them. We've done something from Abhidharma. We've done something from Perfection of Wisdom. We've done a lot from Vajrayana. And we've done Buddhist logic and perception, but we haven't done anything about Vinaya yet. Vinaya is the study of God morality, and it's very important. I can't teach Vinaya details to people who are not ordained, but I can teach the structure of Vinaya, and I think it's useful to know. It's basically what is Vinaya, how do you get Vinaya vows, how many kinds of Vinaya vows are there. You know, roughly what are they? How do you get them? How do you lose them? What do they do to you if you keep them? What do they do to you if you don't keep them? You know, and there's a lot of misinformation, I think, about Vinaya, about monks' vows, nuns' vows, and other subjects like that. So I think without going into detail, which I'm not allowed to do, it'd be really good if you're educated Buddhist, if you understood what the vows are, how people get them, roughly what they are, and how they came to be, what they do to you, things like that. You know, those subjects, I think, my dream is that you're a very educated Buddhist. And if you don't know really that subject at all, then it's a little strange. You know, so, you know, this course has never been taught to non-monks, so it wasn't a problem. So all we can do is do the structure. So we're going to use a short text by Jetsun Kapa, which some people are working on translating right now, and a commentary by Mochu Dharmabhaga, who's in our tantric lineage. Very, you know, we had a little bit of text from him. Very great, wonderful explanation of Vinaya. Really beautiful. So we're going to do that. We'll start around mid-July.
Is it going to cover, you said it covers vow morality, only monks and nuns vow morality?
There's eight kinds, and three of them are for lay people. So that I can cover in detail, and I will cover in detail. So the lay people's lifetime vows and one day vows we'll cover in detail. And then we'll cover the monks and nuns vows, and the novice vows, and the semi novice vows in not detail, but as much detail as I'm allowed to teach you. But I think it'll be nice, because I think you'll be really the first Americans who really, aside from the ordained people, who really understand what the vows are and how they're structured and what they mean and what they don't mean and things like that. So I think it'll be nice for you. Then I imagine that after that I'd like to do the Bodhisattva Charyavatara by Shantideva, which we haven't started and we must do. Sooner or later, we have to do it, so we might as well do it in the late fall or early winter or something. And I imagine we would use a text by Gyaltsen Jay, which Rinpoche taught for 10 or 12 years, and it's never been translated, and it's incredible commentary to the Bodhisattvas, died to the Bodhisattvas in our lives. I'd like to do it, if we don't die first. Okay. Go ahead.
Fundraising.
Please go ahead. Okay.
There's kind of a fundraising.
This is the second principle of death meditation, and it's what? What is the second principle? Yeah. You don't know when you're going to die. Time of death is not. And each principle has three backup reasonings behind it. You know, three facts behind it that show why it's true. So I'll give you. That's why I'm calling this number four, because they call them the nine reasons. You had the first three already.
Can you call number four?
I'm going to give you the three reasons why this is true. But the structure of this is that there's three reasons for the first principle of death, there's three reasons for the second principle of death, and there's three reasons for the third principle of death. And those are called the nine reasons.
So how does four come into that?
We had the first three last week. And now we're going to get 4, 5, 6 under this category.
Yeah.
And then there's going to be 7, 8, 9 under the third principle. I think it's good because when you actually meditate on this, you have to go through the nine reasons. You have to get, they call it Belgom. Belgom means you get so fluent in it that you can say, ah, number five, ah, number eight, ah, two, six. You know, you can, you're supposed to get so good in your meditation that you can just float between them at will. You know exactly what you're doing. If you don't get like that, you probably haven't done this meditation. Say, Zamling.
Zamling.
Se. Mange.
Mange.
Zamling.
Zamling.
Se.
Mange. Mange.
Zamling means Zambling. I think you know now, right? Zambu? Did we talk about Zambu?
Yeah.
So we're living on Zamling. You can say this planet, this world. Okay? The world that we know is Zamling. Okay? You can say planet Earth for now. Same means life, lifespan, lifetime. Mange is the same Mange appearance. Which means what? It's uncertain. It's not fixed. That has a couple of meanings in Buddhism. There are realms. There are certain locations where life is fixed, the lifespan is fixed. There are certain realms where beings are living, where they always live to a certain way, no matter what. The karma to get there is the same karma to see yourself living for 500 years, for example. It's always like that. But we're not living in that kind of realm. In the realm that we live in, Zamling, which you don't have to picture it as a little round continent, you know, halfway away from Mount Meru or whatever. You don't have to think about that. In the realm that you and I know, people do not have fixed lifespans. It's just, it's kind of elementary. Ask Ron Brown, okay? Tian Mange. Lifespan is not fixed. You don't know how long you're going to live. They say in two respects. Do you remember this thing? I mean, in two respects. One is the nature of our karma is to fluctuate. And so the lifespans of beings on our planet fluctuate. Throughout history, it will fluctuate. It will always fluctuate. People, I mean, just the normal, the average length of life will fluctuate. If there's an atomic war or something, the average length of life for the next few thousand years will be much shorter than it is now, just because of the poison that's spreading on the planet. And that's predicted. I mean, that's expected. And then it will drop. It won't be because of the poisonous fallout. The poisonous fallout is a direct, is an expression of your karma from living in a world where people are corrupt and degenerate. So it could have been that, it could have been something else. It will be something. Something will come to express that. And that's not like, that's just a fact of karma. If you live in a world where most people's ethical standard is dropping, then the lifespan on that planet will drop. And it, I don't care what it is. It could be a virus, it could be nuclear fallout, it could be something else that we don't know about yet. But something will come to express the karma, to act out the karma that is created by a whole planet of people's ethical standards dropping, which they are. So it'll, something will come. And lifespans will change again. Lifespans will get shorter. And we'll be here. We'll be one of the people on the planet. And then Pabong Rinpoche and Jetsun Kapa point out another way is this is in a global, I don't know what you would call it, a Celtic level, right? Okay? But on a day-to-day level, it's random. Lifespan is random, meaning there's no proper order to people dying. You know, it should be that the people who get born first die first, and that the people who are born later die later. But in this particular realm that we're in, it's random and it's senseless. You know, it's people's kids die before they die, and people die out of the womb. People die in the womb. People die getting born. You know, and then other people, you know. Sometimes very bad people live a long time. There's no predicting what your past karma is dictating. You can be in this life a very good person, and it doesn't mean that you're going to live longer in this life. This life is mostly projected by forces that happened a long time ago. You know, there's this thing in the Bible of why do the wicked prosper. I mean, that explains it, but it's kind of hard if you're not a Buddhist to explain why, you know, really nasty people live these long, happy lives, and you know, virtuous people die young, and then the opposite happens, and they die at the same time, and there's no sense. It seems to be completely random. So there's no certainty. You can't take any comfort in the fact that you are only so many years old because it's random. There's no predicting that you won't go before someone who's much older than you. When I came to the temple in New Jersey, we had about 15 monks there. And one was Geshe Kalman from, he got TB in a refugee camp in India. He had one lung. And he was wheezing and couldn't walk for, ever since I knew him, could barely talk. And then all these other monks were all healthy and chubby and happy. And 14 of them died, and you know which ones. He was the last one. He survived them all. And then he died, so, you know. You can't tell. You just don't know. One died in a chair eating a roll, and the roll was up to here. And he died. And he just died. And I had to take him to the hospital, remember. And, you know, you don't know. You can't say anything. So that's the first reason. Say, Chikien.
Chikien.
Ma.
Sunken.
Sunken.
Nyum.
Nyum.
Chikien.
Chikien.
Ma.
Ma.
Sunken.
Sunken.
Nyum.
Nyum.
Chikien means things that can kill you. Things that can kill you. Mung means there's a lot. Sunken means things that can keep you alive. And Yum means what?
Little.
Not many. Right. So Kapha divides the Chikien, the things that can kill you, into two. The living ones are like, in Tsongkhapa's day, more than now, wild animals, viruses, and other humans. The inanimate ones he divides into the ones that are outside of you, like a car hitting you, and the ones that are inside of you, which ultimately refers to what are your whole physical body resting on? It's the four elements. What are the four elements? Sa, Chu, Ne, sometimes they say five, sometimes they say six, but these are the main ones. And again, I repeat, and it's something you have to study. It's very interesting. It's in the first two chapters of the Abhidhamma. But Earth is a name given to a certain kind of energy because of its resemblance to Earth. They don't think there's no bits of dirt in your body. Okay? It means an energy that keeps things, I don't know what you want to call it, but I can describe it to you.
Solid.
You can say it keeps things, solidity itself.
Right.
It's solidity itself. Meaning, if the object has this energy in it, it stays in one piece. And when it loses it, it falls apart. As long as it has this energy in it, it can stay up, for example. When this energy goes away, the thing just dissolves. Your body loses this energy in a gross way when it starts to rot in the coffin. So you can say solidity itself. And then water is fluidity and wetness. Those two, they actually have two functions. This is, Earth has the function of hardness and solidity. They each have two. Fire is Sashi Sepa. Heat and burningness or something like that. And wind has the quality of dissipation, you could say. But what it means is, these really are at work in your body. And they are, what do you call it? They're in conflict with each other, all the time. They're in constant conflict with each other. They're always fighting each other. Like Earth, solidity is fighting with dissipation. Wetness is fighting with heat. And they're always struggling against each other. I translated into the dialogue with Doctor for a while, and he said, "Help is an accident." He says the medical tantras of ancient India describe health, which is the balance of these four, as an accidental condition. And that the normal state of a human being is when these four are out of whack. When these four are out of balance, that's the normal condition of a human being. And then you're always sick with something. You know, almost every human being, he gave a lecture to 50 people in Nancy Karen's loft in 1982, something like that. And there were 50 or 60 people there, and he said, "Anyone who's not well, you know, come see me tomorrow." So they look like a normal group of people like you guys. You know, next day, 50 people are lined up outside. I mean, everybody has something. These four are struggling against each other in everybody's body. And for anyone to have them all in perfect unison, which is really just equal amounts fighting each other, that's called health, and that's extremely rare. It's unnatural. And then, so Kapha says, if you want to talk about death being uncertain, the time being uncertain, and you should really look into your own body. Your own body is going to kill you. Sooner or later, your own body will kill you. You know, your body has four elements, four basic energies, which are struggling against each other, and one of them will overcome another one, and that will kill you. You'll get an imbalance in each proportion leads to certain diseases, and it will come sooner or later. It has to come. It's not that they think that there's. It's not something that scientists didn't identify. It's just the basic physical. It's the physics inside the body. And certain energies are working against other energies, and sooner or later you have to die. One of them will destroy the rest. One of them will get so out of balance that the others shut down and they kill you. It kills you. So if you live long enough, your own body will kill you. You know, otherwise you'll get hit by a truck or something like that, or killed by somebody else. But more likely, your own body will kill you. That's in the wheel of life. Who is that? That's that monster holding the wheel. That is the elements in your own body. It represents your own physical body, which is going to kill you sooner or later.
Is that what the Lord of Death in general represents?
Yeah, in general. That's not there is a guy when you get to hell who's standing there, you know, but that's a different thing. It's basically the fact that you're going to kill yourself somehow. You will kill yourself. Yourself will kill yourself. It's very unoptimistic. Okay. The other thing that Tsongkhapa points out is that you remember the Kalpa. What do you call those things? I don't know.
Waves. Cycles.
Kalpa cycles or waves. We are in the end of a swing. We are approaching the nadir. Nadir? Is that the lowest point?
Yes.
Okay. We are approaching that, which means that because of our own tendencies of non-virtue, all the objects in our world become less supportive of life, meaning food becomes less nutritious, you know? And you can see, I guess that's junk food, I don't know. But it means that, and you can see it in India, there's a weird thing in India. No matter how much you eat, I think India has that karma. You know, you can eat all day in India, and just somehow it doesn't make you healthy. It's weird. You know, like when we go to the monastery, they serve us huge meals, and you still get sick after 3 days. You know, there's something about the food just doesn't have the energy there that it has here, and that's no mistake. And there's a reason for everything. And the reason is the karma of the beings who are living there. Yeah.
It's too much of a digression, but another small example is someone's mother used to live like in the mountains of Ecuador and farmed all her own food and herself. Yeah. And she came here and she ate grocery store food, violently ill just from the food, because it's deteriorated and we haven't noticed it because we're acclimatized, and someone outside notices.
Yeah, this food isn't what it used to be. It doesn't give you the nutrition that it used to. And the same thing with vitamins and medicines and things like that. It's weird. You can go to India. There's a kid in our monastery. He got a cut on his leg, and they shoot it up with penicillin, and the guy, it still swells up, and he dies in 2 days. This is something about, it's the karma of the medicines themselves. If they depended on some inherent quality, if they were self-existent, they would cure everybody in the world the same. But somehow, and it really is true, you can make them the same in India, they just don't work as well. There's something about the karma of that country. And we are collectively sharing a kind of karma where all the medical treatments, I mean, we call it, we say, what do they call it? That the immune system is becoming, what, the viruses are becoming immune to our medicines. That's the expression of the fact that our karma is getting lousier. I mean, it could have been anything. So, I mean, it's true that the medicines are losing their, that the viruses are becoming immune to the medicines. But why? I mean, the Buddhist doesn't say it's not true, it is true. But why? Why did it happen now? And why didn't it happen 30 years ago? Why is it happening now? And they say, oh, because AIDS is here and it messes up the viruses and they get more resistant. But why? You know, I mean, it's an expression of our karma. Our karma is getting more degenerate and medicines are working less effectively in general, on the whole.
Why then are lifespans?
Very, very insignificant jobs. You know, generally, we're talking, if it takes 5,000 years to notice anything. You know, we're talking, these. I kind of hate these waves, because these waves really should be a couple miles high or something. We're on a very human history as we know it. Human civilization is an insignificant, you know, micrometer on that wave. And there can be jobs. He said, well, then he says, there's another thing called, it's just more to support number 5. And the whole thing goes like this. Say, Senken.
Senken.
Shikendu.
Shikendu.
Kuru. Senken.
Senken.
Shikendu.
Shikendu.
Kuru. That means that anything that's in this category can become this category. Which means what? Anything that can keep you alive can kill you and will kill you. We once had an exercise in the class that said, maybe anything that keeps you alive can't kill you. You know, I mean, the things that you depend on to keep you alive, which are not very many, transportation, food, you know, money, a house, whatever. But you take, like, a house. You know, you seek shelter in a house so you don't get cold and freeze. But houses kill people. They fall on people. They find radon in them. You know, things like that. Houses kill people. You get into a car in order to further your goal, you know, you get into a plane to get somewhere so that you can live more happy and longer, and then it crashes and you get killed. So the thing that was supposed to help you live longer kills you. And food, people abuse food and then it kills them. You know, and what was supposed to keep you alive ends up killing you. And then even if it's like these people who are very, very careful about food and only eat what they're supposed to eat, which I don't know many like that. I'm not one either. Something goes wrong and it ends up killing you. You know, we had this very, very, I don't know, do you know Los Angeles in New Jersey? His tall monk. He's like 65. He's got big muscles and he's really trim and healthy and he never eats anything he's not supposed to eat. And he's extraordinary and very virtuous and so, you know, some piece of lettuce catches in his intestines. He almost died like a year ago. He took him to the hospital, they cut him open. He came very close to dying. And then it happened again last week. And he just got out of the hospital. So, a nice little piece of healthy food can kill you too, organically grown, lettuce. Really, this guy is like very fastidious and healthy.
Is he a construction worker?
He does, he's a janitor, basically. He works outside. He's 60-something and he carries his big logs and, you know, he's incredible. And he only eats good things. And they almost killed him, very close. The doctor told me if we hadn't taken him in that night, he'd be dead. So you can't tell, you don't know. Anything that's supposed to keep you alive, you can't trust that either.
Okay, that's the nature of our life. The last thing Jetson Kapa says about this point is that, and you can read it in the reading, he says, what do you think life is for? What do you think life is headed? What do you think life is directed at? It's death. No, it is. The only way it can end up is dying. You know, I mean, he says that there's some expression in English, I forget it. Born to die. You know, he says that. He gets into that. He says, you know, what do you think? I mean, the ultimate goal of living is dying. You know, the end of all life is death. So, inherent in all things that keep you alive is death. Inherent in life itself is death. The end of all life is death. And he gets into that, and gets it beautiful. He quotes a lot of ancient scriptures, very beautifully.
And what is Nigyura?
Tikkun Nigyura means turn into. All the things that keep you alive turn into things that can kill you. You always flip flop. They're supposed to keep you alive, and then they end up killing you. Like working. Speaking from personal. Say Lu.
Lu.
Shinto.
Shinto.
Yamcho.
Yamcho.
Lu.
Lu.
Shinto.
Shinto.
Yamcho.
Yamcho.
Lu means what?
Body.
Body. Shinto.
A lot.
It even sounds like what it is. Yeah, very much. Shinto. Extremely.
Extremely.
Shinto means extremely. And when they speak Korkan Tibetan, Shindu. Shindu means Yantu Jane. He's a really bad guy. Shindu. Yangchu means fragile. Is there another word like that? Yangchu can also mean shy, but here it means like a bubble. I don't know how you say that.
Delicate.
Delicate is a good word. It's more like delicate. It's more like extremely delicate. Shintu Nyamcha. And Jetsun Kapa talks about a thorn. You know, how you know, if you just get a small infection from a little prick on the arm of something that's not clean or something, that it can end up killing you. You know, we tend to think of the body as this wonder. I mean, we're brainwashed by, you know, I don't know who, into thinking that the body is this wonderful mechanism and it's all working in perfect harmony and it's, you know, there's this idea of the healthy volleyball player on the beach, you know, and radiant and, you know, nice skin and all everything's healthy and somehow very strong and firm but actually the body is like a bubble, and all it takes to kill it is the slightest thing. You know, it doesn't matter how big and healthy you are, how you know, how strong you look, and how you know, in the glow of their 20s, you know, people just get die like that. It doesn't help. And the difference between the sickest person in this planet and the healthiest person is not much. You know, all it takes is that, and they're both dead. Jetsun Kapa talks a lot about that. And then he says, I mean, compare your body to the planet. You know, I mean, we kind of got a feeling for it when we talked about the end of the planet. And he says, you know, I mean, there was the seventh sun rose. Was it six or six?
Seven.
Six impresses me. Six impresses me. What happened to the number three? There's a poof, and Mount Meru goes up in smoke with the rest of the major features of the whole planet, you know. I mean, you can think of North America just go, you know, just a poof, and it's gone, you know. And Nagarjuna is the one who points that out, you know. He says, I mean, if the planet can be, what do they call it?
Vaporized
in a few minutes by anything. And what, so big deal, a human body, what do you think you are? You know, it's really fragile. It's not. You think of it as air coming through two holes, through these two holes, and by some miracle,
And Nagarjuna is really, he's obsessed by this idea that it's a miracle that out of these two small holes, they haven't got blocked yet for 40 years, you know, that the air has passed through these two tiny, you know, half-inch holes and continues to pass back and forth. This is a miracle. You know, I mean, how many cars are left from 40 years ago? No, really. I mean, how many I'm 52, okay? How many 1952 cars are out on the street? I mean, he says it's a miracle. It's some kind of karmic miracle that you're still alive and that the air is still moving through these two little holes. And if it stops for a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, that's it, you're dead. So if something, energy or any kind of blockage, if anything can stop that air for 3 or 4 minutes, you're dead. That's all. If it stops passing through these tiny little holes, then you're called dead. And it's a miracle that it hasn't happened yet. It must happen. He's very adamant. Nagarjuna, he gets into this long thing in a book called Sitting. He says it's a miracle that you still wake up in the morning. You're still breathing.
So what do you call number six?
Yeah.
What do you call number six?
The delicacy of the extreme delicacy of the body and agility. Extreme. What's the third principle? Other
way.
Yeah. When you do that, this should be like maybe C, I guess. Otherwise you're going to get confused. And we have reasons. 7. And he goes through a list of things that don't help. Okay. And there's this image in the scriptures of your family standing around a beloved father and actually physically grasping onto his arms and legs and begging him not to go. And he goes. There's no choice. He can't stay. And you got to, I think, get this image in your mind of passing to a place where because the chemicals in the body are deteriorating, because the synapses are stopping, the electricity of the body is stopping, and because the physical components of the brain are shutting down, they call it the domino effect in the scriptures. It's called, you know, saw breaks down, affects chew breaks down, affects main breaks down, affects womb. It all starts, the breakdown of each one affects the next one. And so they start to collapse sequentially. And the power of those four elements in your body starts to collapse. What it means in Western terms is that your brain is shutting down. And the brain is not the mind, but the mind rests on the brain. So as the brain is thrown into some really incredible chaos, as everything starts to short circuit, then the mind, which is resting on the brain, starts to reflect that chaos. What it means is you start to hallucinate. You go into some deep hallucinations. Because the brain is breaking down. The mind, which rests on the brain but is not the brain, it also gets thrown into some chaos. And you start to have these there's a classic sequence of hallucinations. And then you're not aware of anything. What I'm trying to say is that every living being in this world that we know, as they die, is reduced to zero as they die. They're back down to zero. You know, it doesn't matter if you were Einstein or a grasshopper. By that point, your mind level is exactly the same. You know, you're going through the same hallucinations. There's no difference between those two beings, essentially. I mean, if you're some great, 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 great yogi, which we're not, and which we probably won't be, it's different. But for normal people, you're basically reduced to zero. Your mind is your brain is chaotic and your mind is chaotic, and that chaos is the same among all sentient beings. So you're basically reduced back to zero. And that nothing can help you at that point. He said it starts out with friends and relatives. I mean, it doesn't matter who you know. You can't recognize anybody anyway. You know, you've already gone past the point where you can't think of and you can't recall clearly any person in your life.
nobody who was your loved one, the one that you spent your life with, anything. There comes a point in that breakdown of the mind where you can't physically see them anymore, then you can't hear them anymore, and then your senses go first, and then your memory is starting to get dim, and then that starts to get reduced. And then you can't remember anybody either. So what's the good? I mean, it doesn't matter who you knew. You know, it doesn't matter what kind of contacts you had or any loved one that you knew. It's all gone. And they're gone forever. I mean, in a sense, you might meet them again karmically 1,000 years later or something. But basically, you came together and you got separated. And there's nothing they can do for you. There's nothing. They can't help you. You're reduced to some kind of primitive mind state, and you're going to be there for a while. And when you come out of it in the Bardo, you won't recognize any of those things anymore. So it's over. I mean, they can't help you. Yeah.
Do all sentient beings in different realms, the animals and pleasure beings, have the same characters, hallucinations? Is it different?
Basically. I mean, formless realm may be different. I don't remember them saying much about it, to tell you the truth. This is a no-brainer. I mean, if your friends and relatives, I mean, there's obviously no physical object which can assist you at that time. It can't reach you. It can't touch you. Your physical senses shut down quite early in the process of death. They shut down in the very early on. It takes much longer for the mind to shut down. But the physical senses are very crude and very gross, and they shut down very fast. So there's no way, I mean, it doesn't matter how many zeros on your bank account, because you can't physically perceive them anymore. You don't have eyes, ears, nose, tongue, or sensation anymore. So you are forever cut off from those things. It doesn't matter what they were. It doesn't matter if your house was the sidewalk or if your house was the White House, because you don't physically have any more means by which to make contact with those things, because your eyes and your ears and your nose are shut down. So it doesn't matter what they were, because you're reduced to zero. Financially, you're reduced to zero. I mean, totally.
You're broke.
Yeah. And everyone's the same. You're equally broke at that moment. I mean, you all have absolutely... It's not only that you don't own anything, it's that even if you did own it, you couldn't see it or hear it or taste it, or you couldn't make any physical contact with it. So it doesn't matter what you used to own. You can't make any contact with it. You might as well be on Mars, because you can't contact it anymore. It cannot affect you anymore. You can't do anything to you anymore. And you can't use it anymore. What's your most intimate material possession? Okay. I see it like a big shrinking process, you know. In the Madhyamika Svatantrika school, there's this huge debate about who is you? Who is the you? You know, and they decide it's your mental consciousness, it's your sixth consciousness, it's your awareness of your thoughts. They said that must be you. Because everything else is just an object for you. So what it means in this sense is you is your possessions. And then life shrinks in more. And then you lose what?
Your mind.
You lose your body, okay? And then you don't have a body anymore either. I mean, you're shrunk down to your mind, basically. You have shrunk down to a mind. There is no more body. I mean, if you think about it coming in from the outside, first you lose your loved ones, then you lose your things, then you lose your own body, and the only thing left is your mind. And that's the point at where Western civilization makes the great mistake of thinking that because the body stops moving, the mind must have stopped. It's an assumption and it's a wrong assumption. There's no proof for it at all. It's only a wild assumption that because the physical body can't run anymore due to its own problems, that the mind, which is totally different stuff, must have shut down too. The mind must be dying also. It's a gross, mistaken assumption, and it's not true. Yeah.
Another classic misfortune to someone who would put forth the idea that
mind stops in the body.
Yeah, we studied it. We had a whole class. It takes about 6 weeks to cover the whole thing. Second chapter, Dharma Kirti's Pranavartika. We debated that in Smarapa. Twice. So the body, you just think of yourself as shrinking down to a mind. And that's all that's left. And the imprints in the mind. What's left in the mind? What are the imprints left in the mind? And here's where you get into the wheel of life, Gepa Sepa Gupa Lamba. Link number 8 and link number 9. These are the thoughts you have as you die. And they do a thing called Suddhapa. Suddhapa means to make a selection. It's like that lady sticks her hand in the lottery thing and pulls out something. And your mind at that point, at a very specific point as you die, makes a Suddhapa. It selects a karma. And that karma becomes activated like an atomic bomb, you know, like Chupa Sipa. Chupa Sipa is link number 10. Somewhere between link number 8 and 9 and 10, your mind activates one of the karmas. That determines a lot of what you're going to be next. That pretty much determines what's going to happen to you next. And that selection process, which doesn't take more than a few seconds, is based on your own lifetime of behavior. You know, if your behavior was virtuous during your whole lifetime, basically the selection will most likely be virtuous. The karma that's thrown ahead will be good. And if you've led a 50-50 life, we've got a 50-50 selection problem. And if you've led basically a lousy life, then the selection will be bad. So that's why only Dharma can help you. We're talking about a few minutes of thinking as you die. Something is activated by your character that's been formed throughout your whole life. And if it's Dharma, then you'll have a good selection. And if it's not Dharma, you won't. And that's why only Dharma can help you. Your mind is down to a very primitive level. You are not thinking clearly. It's instinctual. You know, if you've led a virtuous life, the virtuous instincts take over. And if you've led a non-virtuous life, the non-virtuous instincts prevail. And whatever prevails throws your head at that moment.
Does this process of picking up this karma happens after the separation of mind, of karmic consciousness or mind from the body, or at the time where they still have some link?
They don't say, but I think I believe the bhava would happen after that. So it's happening before the bhava. And I think the bhava begins with the separation of your mind from your body. But your body is already basically shut down.
So actually, but the consciousness is still in the body.
Related to the body, yeah.
In the moment that this flesh.
I think so. I mean, I've never seen it detailed like that. You could say it's at the moment of. It's at the final moments of that. As the mind leaves the body. But that gets into. You have to study something higher than that. That's a secret teaching.
Now, when you talk about virtue in this context, does that include wisdom?
Yeah, but very, very little. I mean, it includes wisdom in the sense that if you see emptiness, for example, you cannot select a bad karma. It's impossible. It's totally impossible.
But to be virtuous in this context, you have to have some sort of grasp in the Dharma context.
Yeah.
Strong grasp.
Well, an intellectual understanding of emptiness assures that you cannot select a bad seed. And a direct understanding of emptiness assures that you will only have incredibly cool seeds. And it's a comfort. I mean, when it happens to you that you see emptiness directly, you perceive this fact. You know this fact. You will never again take anything less than a dharmically perfect circumstance. You'll be born in a country that's all Dharma. You will only have friends who are Dharmic. You will have incredibly great lamas from early in your life. And you will see emptiness again soon. And you won't have more than 6 or 7 more lives like that. And then you're out. And you're Buddha. And you'll see that. And you know that. And it's some kind of incredible feeling that you know. And it's just some kind of, I don't know.
it's like a guarantee. And you can just look ahead and say, oh, that's going to be nice. That's cool. But even an intellectual understanding prevents the lower birth. You cannot select the lower birth after that. After the certain stage in the second of the five paths, you cannot take the lower birth. Why? Ignorance has a... It's not that you don't collect the karmas, it's that they can't be activated properly if you have a certain amount of wisdom. You have the karmas, you have the bhakchas, they can't be activated. The difference between link number two in the Wheel of Life, if you came Friday night, you know it. And link number 10 is the... I always tell people, you got to go see Broken Arrow, you know? With John Travolta. And they give me a kickback, actually. No. It's this whole movie. It's a very boring, exciting movie about atomic bomb. And they steal two atomic bombs, but they keep activating them and unactivating them, you know. Once they get activated, you can't unactivate them, but they figure out how to activate them. There's this feeling that once it's activated, you're in trouble. You know, there's bombs, atomic bombs laying around the whole movie, but some of them get activated, and then people have to run, you know. There's nothing else to do. And it's exactly the same thing. The difference between link number two, which is called Dhruche Kibbe Samskara, and link number 10, which is called Chitta Sipa, is activation, the question of activation. Does the karma ever get activated or not? And that's the whole difference. Karma number two is immature karma. Karma number 10 is activated and it's going to blow up. It's like that counter is counting down like in the movie. It's just like that. It's been activated and nothing's going to turn it off. You go as far as activating it, you screwed up big time. You've got to not activate. And that has to do with your understanding of emptiness. Yeah.
So are you saying if you have an intellectual understanding of emptiness, but you break your
10-minute goal, how do you not become emptiness? They say that you don't break certain things after that.
So it precludes non-virtuous
behavior. There's certain behaviors that you may still do bad deeds, but they never get activated. And then basically, I mean, the basic things you wouldn't do those things. In their full form, if you study the Bodhisattva Vows, you know how much the four attitudes play a part. You know? You would never knowingly, purposely, gladly, you know, break a vow. You might mess up and then feel bad or something like that, but you will never, again, you know, happily, knowingly, consciously, purposely, break a vow, which is all necessary, for example, to break a root when it's out of the vow. You just can't do it anymore, because you saw the truth. We'll take a break. We have a little bit left, very short. The death meditation has, you know, Tibetans love the three this and the four this, you know that by now. The three principles which you've already had, there's nine reasons which you've already had, three reasons for each principle. And then the bottom line is that you're supposed to make three resolutions. The first resolution is in reaction to the first principle, which was what? Is that it's certain that you can't. I think for us, very practically, studying emptiness and keeping your bodhisattva vows. Those are you've got all that information. People who are in their bodhisattva vow class, you know that. And then study emptiness, basically study Lamrim. Keep all your vows. I'm thinking study and keeping your vows. And then trying to reach bodhicitta, trying to reach that compassionate state. But I'd say those things. But if I were going to say very briefly, this is actually the whole thing. Renunciation, bodhicitta, and understanding of emptiness. Understand suffering, understand compassion, and study emptiness. I mean, those, if you have to say three things, those are the three. Mm-hmm. Understand suffering, study compassion, and learn to see emptiness. I mean, that's the whole thing. Everything else fits into those three. Yeah.
Here you mentioned the five precepts. Is that
That comes.
You just assume that? Is that after the bodhisattva class?
When I say bodhisattva class, they actually, you have to take some kind of precepts before you can have bodhisattva class. Right. I'm just considering them part of the bodhisattva. Or you either have to take some kind of layman stuff.
Right. Well, that's what I thought. This is why I wondered. You just sort of assumed the five.
Or you have to be. You have to know and keep the 10 virtues. Even if you don't take those. So I mean, there's what I'm trying to say is there's a place there for people who have never taken any vows. Mm-hmm. That's just practicing. That's just avoiding the 10 non-virtues. So that's the basis, foundation. And then based on that, you can take bodhisattva vows. You have to have that before you can take bodhisattva vows.
Why would you study compassion rather than practice?
Well, I mean study in the sense of learn to develop it. I mean study in that old sense of study to be, you know. What was the second principle?
The time of death is uncertain.
I think the key here is quit worldly work. You know, people want to know what's quit worldly work. And there were students in New Jersey 25 years ago when I was there who immediately went out into the forest in Howell and tried to live there, and they came back after 3 days all cold and hungry. And obviously it doesn't work. There's other people who went to India and stayed there, you know, and got old there and then came back to America. So you can't live there, and, you know, there's no dentist there and stuff like that. And, you know, I mean, it didn't work. I think all those people came back that I know of. Very few ever stayed there. What I mean is you have, quitting worldly work doesn't mean quitting your job. It's a very delicate balance. You know, you have to have a living that doesn't hurt other people. And ultimately, in the highest levels of Buddhism, which were designed for Indian kings who were very busy, you can be at work. But the point is that you have to be practicing. Work has to become practice. So pick a job that will remind you of your practice. And that's about the only criterion I can think of for a job. I mean, if you have a problem with anger, then work someplace. Like, we'll go work at the Angry Monk. I'm not kidding at all. Let the work that you do be something that you've consciously decided upon to remind you of your own faults. You know, if you have a problem with vanity, then go work as a clothier or something. You know what I mean? Or something like that. But let your work be something that relates to your spiritual life. And let it only be that. And choose it on that basis, because you'll never forget why you're there. You know, people will ask you, why the hell are you a cook? You could have been a physics major. You know, you say, well, I had a problem of where I didn't want to help other people. You know, and I chose this for humility's sake. Something like that. And let your work be that. Seriously. It's very hard, but it's very satisfying. And because work is a joke. I mean, otherwise, it's for collecting money. That's by definition a lost cause. You know, you can't keep it, and it's just going to kill you. You're just going to pass the money on to someone else. So if you're working just for money, it's meaningless. Choose something that will promote your Dharma practice. Atisha had many students. He only took one to Tibet with him. He took the most obnoxious student he had. And quite consciously, he made that student his close disciple, his closest disciple, because he wanted to constantly be tested. You know, and let your work be symbolic. Do something which has a symbolic meaning for you. And make it into practice. On the other hand, because any other reason for working doesn't mean anything. Working is meaningless. Make it meaningful. And make an honest living. Don't hurt other people. And make it something that reminds you of your spiritual life. And then, and don't get caught up in it. You know, keep this distance from it like a snake. I've seen so many Dharma students say, I'm just going to go work for 3 years and then I'll have enough money to really practice. And they separated their work from their practice in the first place. And then they never came back to what they thought was practice anyway.
and they're still working out there. You know, I know where they are. One's at Pennsylvania University. You know, I'm still saying, you know, next year for sure. You know, and it won't happen. Those could fall into that, but your work can become your practice, and it must be. Ultimately, in the highest teachings of Buddhism, it's perfectly consistent to be working any kind of job, from a janitor to a president of Warner Communications, and be a totally perfect practitioner. There's no problem with that. And in practical terms, I think you must have a job that doesn't leave you exhausted at the end of the day, and that leaves you time for your long retreats and things like that. You must have that time. You know, I think any other job is dangerous.
That really narrows it down.
I know, your choice. What's your choice? What's your choice?
What do you mean?
What's the choice? You don't have any choice. What's the option? There's no option. There really is no option.
Well, that's what I was saying. There's no options for work.
No, there are.
that's what I think.
No, there are. There are many. And I would throw in another thing, that you should have a serious career. And it shouldn't be just Dharma bumming. So it's weird, you have to have a serious career, part-time, doesn't leave you exhausted. you know, it's hard to find, but I think if you work on it, most people just stop and don't work on it. But I think you need something like that. I think you need to find something like that. And you shouldn't be in a job that doesn't provide for your needs. You know? There's a lot of Dharma students I know are getting this midlife Dharma crisis where they didn't learn anything, they don't have a trade or a skill or a profession, and they feel bad, and they start to lose their vows. 15 Western Sangha have just wrote this last year, who've been monks and nuns for 20 years or something. They reach this midlife crisis where they, you know, they haven't done anything, they haven't learned anything, they don't have a regular career. You gotta have a sustenance. You have to have an honest living that doesn't hurt other people. And then you absolutely must, at all costs, carve out the time you need, or you are fooling yourself and you're going to die and you'll be lost. You know, you'll literally be lost. The whole meaning of your life will be lost. And it's a big challenge and it's a big stakes. You know, that your life is extraordinarily precious, and every day is precious, and you have to carve out the time you need, and it's not easy in our society. Our society is working against you, but you have to do it, and it's a personal thing that you have to do. You know, the class stops tonight, and it says, I can't do anything after that. You know, it's up to you. You can't, you know, you have to design your own life, but don't kid yourself. I mean, you must have couple hours a day of practice, must have, minimum. And then you need times when you can devote yourself only to practice. And you have to worry about how to pull it off. I can't. And if you don't, then you will suffer. And your life won't have any meaning. You'll come to the end and you'll be very sad that you wasted your time. You'll be sad that you didn't make the time. You'll realize you made a mistake. So that's just each person has to do themselves.
Should it specifically be like an antidote to what you approach?
Well, I think anything, depending on your level and depending on what, I don't say just an antidote, and I don't say that you have to change careers at this point, but maybe stop looking at it the way you, don't look at it as an income or as a sustenance. Look at it as a laboratory for your practice. I don't think there's any circumstance more beneficial for practice than an American office setting. You know, I found it to be very fruitful. And I'm not just kidding. I mean, I've had the chance to have every kind of, my boss has encouraged me to do that. You know, legal lies, and there's ladies all over the place, and there's people screaming at me, and there's people for me to be jealous of who have a position that's just a little higher than mine. And I think you have everything in a normal office, you've got everything. It's a very precious thing if you look at it the right way. And then as you get more and more far along in the teachings, it becomes a whole different thing for a higher level of practice. And you need it. Ultimately, you need other people around to practice. And we're actually going to do a text about that.
I think when we do the Vinaya, you need other people around to reach the highest levels of Buddhism. You need other people around. It's done relative to other people. You have to have other people around you to get there. Without them, you can't do it. So you need a study where you have some people around you. Where is all sentient beings? I mean, the people around you right now. Because you're not going to meet all sentient beings. You have time. It's the ones in contact with you who will push you up to enlightenment. Okay. What's the third resolution? A third principle. Knowing nothing else can help, practice only Dharma. We're opening a bookstore, you know, and I get all these people coming to me and saying, oh, you should have this book, you know. And I start to get dizzy with all the views in the world, you know, all the world views. You know, they say, are you going to carry this Pali thing, or this Sri Lankan thing, and this Thai thing is really good, and this Korean thing is neat, and here's something by this American philosopher that's really cool, and... you know, and I start to get, I got a little dizzy, you know, I started to think, you know, you know. But there's a definition of a Dharma book in the scriptures. It says if a book doesn't have the capacity to lead you to nirvana and enlightenment, don't even waste your time. You know, the book doesn't deal with how to get to enlightenment and nirvana. For God's sake, don't waste your precious human lifetime, you know. And that applies to magazines, and newspapers. Know what's going on, be informed. Do not spend Sunday for 2 hours, 3 hours with the New York Times, you know. It's just your mind, your healthy mind, space and time is extremely short and extremely precious. And expose the mirror of your mind only to things which can enlighten it. You know, and that means that those very holy books, Shantideva, you know, things by the Buddha, things by Nagarjuna, you know, seek out those things and only expose your mental real estate, that precious, irreplaceable real estate. You know, fill it with those things because you don't have time. There's no time. And you know, sometimes you get tired, go read a novel, it's okay, see a movie or something. When you use it for when you get tired, but otherwise, only expose your mind to good things and things that can really purify it, because you don't have the leisure to expose it to every different interesting viewpoint in the world, and they won't get you enlightened. If you're at this stage, you've already come to this class, you've already reached a certain level, then don't waste that precious time on other things. You don't have time, and it, everything you read gets imprinted on your mind stream. And everything you expose your mind to, meaning other people and books and TV and music and everything, makes a certain imprint on your mind. And expose it to the great holy beings of history. You know, you have Nagarjuna, you have Tsongkhapa, you have the Dalai Lama. You know, expose your mind to those things, because whatever you expose it to is going to be stuck there. It all makes an imprint. And then there's times when you got to take a break, you know. And Lama Yeshe, who's a very holy Lama, would say, you know, go home after work. If you can't sit down and read Tsongkhapa, which you can't after work, you know, get a cool drink, go lay down in your bed and think compassion thoughts for other beings. And there's a special thought that's useful here. And that's a good way to end death meditation. It's like star, star. I mean, in the whole Lam Rim, which contains the entire teachings of the Buddha, I think this is the most important line. And it says, it's talking about a thing called Namdak. Say Namdak.
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 Namdak is described in the Lam Rim. And it's a practice where you see the whole world as something pure and something... it's sort of this, what do you call that? What do you call that thing where you think where everybody's out to get you?
Paranoia?
Yeah, it's a reverse paranoia. It's a reverse paranoia. It's where you think the whole world is out to help you. And the whole world has been planned around your enlightenment. Every event that happens to you during the day has been what do you call it, orchestrated by the Buddha and Bodhisattvas to get you enlightened. And that's a very, very powerful, and it's actually true. Okay? We're all, John McCain, we've all been waiting. We had to come to this stupid class and waiting for you. But I mean, it's kind of a reverse paranoia where you think every person you meet is some kind of holy being who's been waiting for you to wake up. And they've all been waiting for you to purify your life and your heart. And they're doing everything they can to get you there, even if it's screaming at you or criticizing you or something, you know. And there's a reason why there's this place on Sixth Street, and there's a reason why New York was put on the East Coast, because you were there, you know. And it's this kind of sweet, crazy mind that believes that the whole world is out to assure your enlightenment, and it's something that you have to develop. It's very important, and it's actually true. So you have to work on that. There's no one in your life who's there by accident. And there's no place or thing in your life which is there by accident. It's all been orchestrated for certain ultimate spiritual goals, you know, for your benefit. Something like that. Yeah.
Is this the same thing as seeing the purity?
Yeah, that's it.
What was the question?
Same thing. So, that's all. That's my dish. Now, I can't. We have, like, I like to take a month off or two. And that's exactly what I'm going to be doing. And I cannot do death meditation for you. I sometimes feel bad because I get up here and we go through the whole thing. I see it carefully recorded everywhere. I know where my notes are from Dharamsala. I've never opened them since that 20 years ago. And I don't know how to make it part of your life. I think you have to, when you do your morning meditations, you have to think of these nine reasons. And it's, if you, I my own observation of practice is that you have to do something fresh every month or two. You know, you do your meditations in the morning or evening, whatever is better for you. And stay on one subject for like a month or two. And for example, death meditation. Now you have a nice death meditation. We did the whole realms. Why? I mean, the point is, when the air stops moving through those two little holes, you're going to be in one of those realms. And we tried to prove, if you understand emptiness, we tried to prove why those realms are possible. If things are empty, then those realms are possible. Because all it takes to get there is what? It's a shift in your own projections. You know? It's not like a big trip to go on. You don't have to get a reservation on an airline. You know, if all it takes is for your mind to shift slightly, and you are in those realms. Because they consist of your projections. So all it takes is a shift, is a few moments of your mind shifting. As much as your mind shifting from upstairs here to the downstairs when you put your shoes on, that takes more sambas than it takes to get to hell. You know, it takes a hell of a lot more sambas to go from this floor after class down and put your shoes on than it takes to go to hell. Than it takes to become a hell being. Much more. So it will happen, and it does happen in a few seconds of thought, and you're there. So it's just a shift in your own mind, and you're there. It's as easy to get there as that, and that's very close. That gets a little nervous, you know. So you have to meditate on death. And the reason we went through all those realms, it's not just, you know, to do this dry Abhidharma stuff. It's to realize that those realms are all possible. And Vasubandhu is not an idiot. He would not describe those realms if there weren't something there. Which you can confirm by reading the rest of his book. I mean, somebody who describes in details 15 seconds of the perception of emptiness is not going to be a fool about the hells. You know? He knows something. He's trying to warn us about something. So, you know, you have to do a death meditation. Do it every day. You cannot get this from a class. You have to meditate on it. You have to get it from getting used to it by doing it every single day. You have to do it every single day. So you have the death meditation. It's up to you. I can't. My job ends now. I can't do anything else. If you don't do it, then this class is totally useless. You know, hearing about it once is almost totally ineffective. It can't do anything to your life. It won't change your life at all, I promise you. You have to meditate on it. It has to get infused in your mind through doing it. Now do it for two months, you know. Let's make a deal, okay? Like, try to do it for 2 months. Do that death meditation. You have the whole text, and you'll get the second half now. And try to do it. It will not affect you otherwise, and nothing will happen. Kadampa Lama said that if you don't have death meditation, you can't achieve anything. You won't achieve anything. So that's why we're doing it first. And it won't have any effect if you don't do it. And the test is if you change your mind. And if you don't find yourself changing from this class, then go quit and go do something. Yeah, really. I'm a little scared because I'm not sure people feel they're changing. You know? If you're not changing, then something's wrong. You're not doing something. You know, you have the information. You're probably not doing it every morning. You know? I would guess. If you're not changing, then change, because then do something. Because if your life is not getting sweeter and more holy, then there's something wrong. Then you're not doing it. There's no reason to come to class there. There's no reason to have a class. Because it's not just to learn more information. That doesn't help. It doesn't affect the brain at the moment of death. You know? It's the internalization that comes from frequent meditation every day. And if you skip 2 or 3 days a week, it won't happen either, I guarantee. You have to do it every day.
Yeah. When you say do this death meditation every day, are you talking about as you're walking around, developing the awareness as you described, or are you talking about sitting down?
I'm talking about both, but now I'm talking mainly sitting in the morning. Because if you meditate on it in the morning, it'll start to affect your day. and let it be your subject for the next 2 months. And then we'll go to another subject. But I find that after 2 months, almost 2 or 3 months exactly, I lose all progress on that subject, and I have to move on. It gets a dry. I don't know about you, but they last about 2 months for me. Yeah.
What you said at the beginning of this, as I understood it, was the main point is to walk around, you know, thinking I'm going to die today, to develop that feeling, and that was death meditation. That was death.
It is. It is the awareness, but you have to be doing it. Doing it in the morning is what triggers it during the day. And what we said death meditation wasn't was just getting panicked about death and then not doing anything. It's supposed to be some kind of healthy fear that motivates you to think. And if you ever get to a point during the day when you really believe this is your last day on earth, you'll do really good things. And you'll do it every day. It's very interesting. It's a very interesting effect. You know, every day that you really pull this off and think, this is my last day on this planet with my friends. This is my last time I'm going to see Fran Perella. You know, I better be nice to her. You know? That's a very intelligent way to live. And it doesn't matter even if there's no Buddhism or no enlightenment. It's still the best way to live. You know? So, do it. That's all. We'll meditate a little bit afterwards, okay? So we'll do the prayer and then hold it for a while. And dedicate it to all the sentient beings who, you know, there's all these jillions of sentient beings just dying, and they don't know what's happening. And they never went to a class. They have no, they're just helplessly dying. And dedicate it for them that they learn these things.